From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany has tested positive for the coronavirus, adding another member of President Trump's inner circle to the list of those who are now COVID positive. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows told Fox and Friends this morning that President Trump may be released from Walter Reed Medical Center as soon as today.
We're still optimistic that based on his unbelievable progress and how strong he's been in terms of his fight against this COVID-19 disease, that he will be released, but that decision won't be made until later today.
Trump has been hospitalized for COVID-19 since Friday night. Yesterday, he stirred controversy, going out to greet supporters in a motorcade, potentially risking the health of the Secret Service members in the car with him. For more, we're joined by NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Ayesha, what is the latest that we know about the president's condition today?
Well, we haven't been briefed today at this point by any medical officials. We do know what, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said, which is that the president had improved overnight and that he thinks that he could possibly come home as soon as today. That is what medical officials said yesterday. But we've been getting this rosy picture from members of the medical staff and sometimes from White House officials that seems to be contradicted when you look at the actual treatment that the president has been receiving. He's receiving experimental treatments, including the steroid that has some negative side effects and is usually only given to people when they have a very serious case of the coronavirus. So it's not totally clear what state the president is in right now.
Well, if he did leave the hospital today, and we know that the coronavirus can kind of go up and go down and things can get better and then they can get worse, what would his care look like at the White House?
Well, there is a very extensive medical team at the White House. I think it's a 30-member team. Obviously, presidents have to have top-of-the-line care, and there's a lot at the White House itself where he could still be receiving treatment and still be getting, very serious medical treatment at the White House. It wouldn't have all of the equipment that you have at the hospital, but you would have a lot there.
Vice President Pence, meanwhile, is set to travel to Utah today, where the vice presidential debate is going to be held on Wednesday. Pence did get a negative coronavirus test result, but he was in close contact with the president, and sometimes it takes a while for these things to show up in the tests. According to the administration's own guidelines, should he be traveling to Utah?
Well, what Pence's doctor has said is that he does not count as a close contact with the president because he was traveling last week. And so that is the Pence's office is saying that he has been cleared to travel because his doctor is saying that he was not in close contact with the president, I guess, for an extended period of time. So that is their defense of him traveling. We may hear more from him today with him, set to head out. But there are just a lot of questions about the way the administration has handled this and about these decisions to keep up these public appearances.
Well, and what is the administration saying in defense of what has been criticized by many, which was the president leaving the hospital yesterday to get in his motorcade in a car with Secret Service agents, maybe putting them at risk of getting COVID-19 from him and doing that? Have they defended that?
Yes, Mark Meadows today, he brought this up to Fox and Friends. And basically what he said is that these Secret Service agents were around the president, have been around him basically anyway. And that, and they also say that they took all the necessary precautions. They say that they got the approval of the medical staff before they did this ride around to wave at supporters. So their argument is that they took precautions, that they were wearing masks and other, protective equipment, and that these are people who have already been exposed to the president anyway. So they are making the argument that it was okay. Obviously, the issue that some people would bring up is that this was not an emergency. This wasn't an exposure that had to happen. And so that is why they're being questioned about this.
Uh-huh. Aisha, I mentioned that Kayleigh McEnany, the press secretary, has now tested positive for COVID-19. The numbers just keep growing inside the White House and close to the president. Just briefly, are people worried there that you're talking to at the White House just about their own situation because of all this outbreak at the White House?
I mean, I have to imagine so. And you haven't had a lot of contact tracing being done by the White House. There are people, reporters who have tested positive for the coronavirus who are at the White House who say they haven't been contacted. They haven't been very public about these things. So I think the concern is there.
NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe, thank you.
Thank you.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice says it's nearly done with its review of the officer-involved shooting on August 23rd. The shooting severely wounded a black man, Jacob Blake, in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Among those waiting for the report are Kenosha business owners. Many of them have tightened security out of concern over the potential for more civil unrest beyond what took place in the first nights after Blake was shot. Chuck Quernbach with member station WUWM reports businesses also have a long-term worry: how to appeal to customers who support the police and those who support Blake.
The unrest of late August saw the burning of several Kenosha businesses, and today many establishments that survived remain boarded up and painted with messages supporting the Black Lives Matter movement. That's the case at Jack Andrea, a gift shop at the edge of a Kenosha neighborhood known as Uptown.
Oh, thank you, dear.
A customer thanks co-owner David Andrea for holding open the door to the store that's been in his Italian immigrant family for more than 100 years. A painting on a new wooden outer door refers to the fictional nation of Wakanda and its hero, Black Panther. On another side of the building, a painted window board says, "Change gonna come." Andrea says he likes the paintings, but admits some of his customers don't.
There's some people that don't understand, and we got some pushback on that from some customers. They won't shop here anymore. And, you know, I did expect that we might get a little of that, but that's okay. I mean, certainly it's a free country, and they're entitled to their opinions and things.
Andrea says it's possible the Black Lives Matter paintings will win him new customers, but he says he'd really prefer the boards come down and let more sunlight into the shop. He's waiting to see if there's further unrest in Kenosha. About 20 business owners from the Uptown neighborhood gathered recently in a local bar to talk about their next steps. A Jillian Burrell Warfield is black. She owns the beauty salon Textures RX. She says she has a diverse clientele, including white customers from her previous job at a chain outlet who had been coming to her shop since she opened it 2 years ago. But Burrell Warfield says that's stopped since the August fires, meaning a significant loss of income.
I've learned how to budget my money and what to spend on and what not to spend on. So will my rent be paid? Yeah. Will I be able to do extracurricular? No. But my rent will be paid, yes.
Burrell Warfield says if and when her white customers come back, she'll try to stay neutral on what's been happening in Kenosha. Staying neutral is also the strategy of a barber who has not put boards on his windows and doors.
Come on, right now.
Michael Johnson talks into his cell phone, telling a customer to come in right away. Johnson, who's black, says his shop, called Fade City, also has a diverse customer base, and that business over the last few weeks has been stable. But Johnson says he notices that his customers don't linger or go to other neighborhood stores anymore. He says he hopes to attract more business by doing his best to keep politics out of his place.
You think about this. In certain businesses, certain conversations can't even be held no way. Whether it's right or wrong, I wouldn't know. I just know what works for me in here. You know, we've had political conversations where it got a little heated. So that's what made me make that decision.
Johnson says he's worried there are more demonstrations to come in Kenosha, what with the unresolved police shooting case involving Jacob Blake and the possible trial for Kyle Rittenhouse, the Illinois teenager accused of killing two protesters 2 nights after Blake was wounded. That concern is evident in downtown Kenosha, too.
Oh, I put it in the back. Sorry. Okay.
The midday mood is friendly inside Frank's Diner. Co-owner Kevin Irvin says customers are coming in, though he still has a board on his front window, and there are boards still on many other establishments, making for what Irvin calls a dismal neighborhood atmosphere. Irvin says his business's bottom line might not withstand more violence.
It's the uncertainty of the unrest and what's that's going to bring. Is that going to keep tourists away? Because Kenosha depends a lot on tourist dollars. So, yeah, no, we can't really stand much more.
Irvin says with COVID-19 this year, he's been able to adjust his business, adding services like takeout and outdoor tables. He says he'd rather be able to focus on the pandemic than the protests. But he may have to worry about both for some time to come. For Here and Now, I'm Chuck Quirnbach in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
And here in California, this wildfire season is shattering records. The state reported on Sunday that wildfires have burned more than 4 million acres so far this season. That's 26 times more than this time last year. For the latest, let's bring in Sarah Hosseini, reporter with KQED in San Francisco. And Sarah, you were out near the Glass Fire over the weekend, and that fire is still burning in Napa and Sonoma. What's the latest there?
Well, there's more than 65,000 acres and 800 structures that have burned so far. It's about 30% contained. But the weather is starting to cooperate. Over the weekend, we had calmer winds, cooler temperatures, and some clear skies. I talked to firefighters who told me they were able to look out their window and see the mountains for the first time in a week. And that allowed aircraft to fly over the steep terrain and make some big gains. So I would say officials are cautiously optimistic that they'll be able to keep the fire from spreading over their lines into communities.
Mm. You spoke with the family, the Hinsons, when you were there, who they've had to evacuate 3 out of the last 4 years. This year, they tragically lost their home. Let's listen.
Well, right now, we're registered with FEMA and all them, and apparently they're supposed to give us temporary housing, or they'll put trailers on our property until we rebuild and stuff. So,
So in the Hinson's case, they're focused on rebuilding, but they don't have home insurance. So does that mean that they're waiting primarily on FEMA?
Yeah, they'll really be relying on FEMA and groups like the Red Cross, but they can't get any assistance until the Trump administration declares the latest couple of blazes, including the Glass Fire, a major disaster. And that's something Governor Gavin Newsom asked it to do last week.
Mm. The Glass Fire is just one of 23 active fires burning in the state. Some of them have actually been burning since August, and it's now October. What can you tell us about the status of some of those other fires?
The thing that's remarkable is that the Glass Fire is actually one of the smaller fires. It's dangerous and destructive, but many, many fires are much larger than this one. The number one fire is the August Complex Fire. It started mid-August with a bunch of different lightning strikes that have subsequently created fires that burn together about 150 miles north of San Francisco. As of this morning, it's burned 1 million acres, and it's sort of hard to get your head around that number, but that's bigger than the state of Rhode Island. There's several other large fires burning up here in the north part of the state. One of the most destructive is the North Complex, burning in the mountains east of Paradise. And you'll remember that name. That's the town where 85 people died in the campfire 2 years ago. And it's burned over 300,000 acres and still going. In the southern half of the state, you know, we have others, including the Bobcat fires near L.A., which not quite as big, but troublesome because of where it is.
Yeah. 2018 was the worst year on record in terms of acres destroyed. 2020 has already doubled that, as you kind of laid out for us. What are climate scientists saying about this year? Are we at a tipping point?
I think everybody now sees that these wildland fires are behaving in a fundamentally different way. They're burning faster, and their capacity to move really long distances quickly seems different. So people who have been fighting fires a really long time and scientists will tell you that, you know, climate change is driving this extreme weather and intense fires. And, I think there's, in terms of a tipping point, I think there's more of a conversation, maybe even consensus now, that how we deal with management and preemptive measures, including like prescribed burns, something that Native Californian people used to do, might be the way to go. And the state and federal government actually have started talking about that.
Sarah Hosseini is reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
With just a few weeks before the election, we're talking to you about the issues you care about and who you plan to vote for. Today, we visit the state of Kansas, a Republican stronghold. President Trump won 56% of the popular vote in 2016, but recently Democrats have made some ground, picking up a House seat and governor's race during the primaries. KMUW reporter Stephen Basaha visited the Old Town Farm and Market in downtown Wichita to find out what's on voters' minds.
It's a smallish farmer's market, but there's a lot of different things here. There's a guy who hand paints different buildings, icons in Wichita. There's lots of fresh produce, baked goods. The people here are great. They're very friendly. The dogs are wonderful to pet. That's why I come here, is the dogs. Not going to lie. My name is Gio Bondurant. I'm a guest teacher, and I'm an independent. So in March, I lost my job being a guest teacher for the school district because schools shut down. So this whole summer, I've been relying on unemployment, which I like to think the best incentive to get off unemployment is to be on unemployment. I've had to be on hold for 4 hours at a time, and that's if they don't hang up on me. And now I'm going to be forced to go back to the classroom, even though I do miss it, because $165 a week just won't cover a whole lot. I am definitely planning to vote this election. I feel that the person in the White House has pretty much destroyed America, and we need to get him out. I will be voting for Biden. I'm not enthusiastic about him, but the other options are just too horrible to think about. He's our best hope to get out of whatever we're in right now.
Yes, we make everything ourselves. Most of our salt starts out as white sea salt.
I'm Robert Nolan. I am a communications manager. I am 49 years old. I am a Caucasian white male. And I am a Republican. I am planning to vote, and we vote every election. We just do it every time. It's important to make sure that we do our part to make sure our voices are heard when it's time to make a choice for who's going to represent us or run the government for us. The pro-life issue is the most important issue for us. It's not the only thing, but that's the main thing that I look at. There were other factors that could affect who I vote for, but that's the most important. I'm going to vote for President Trump. I don't like where Joe Biden wants to take the country. I think his stand on all these riots is just ridiculous. I don't appreciate the fact that he hasn't stood up and said where the direction we need to go. All he's telling me is why he doesn't like President Trump. I really don't know where he wants us to go. I know where we're headed right now with the president we have.
I am Jane Shirley. I am 67 years old, Caucasian female. I'm a nurse, and I vote Democrat. I intend to vote because I'm discouraged about the direction our country is going in, and I really want to see a change. We are becoming so polarized that I feel like we aren't making progress. I've worked for years in public health. I'm very concerned about the fact that we are now in this public health crisis, but we had lost an enormous amount of support and funding for public health over particularly the last 4 years, both nationally and statewide, and that's part of the reason that we're in the mess that we're in right now. And to recover from COVID, to recover from the Trump administration, I think we need to see politicians who are willing to work together. Historically in Kansas, it's been a Republican state, but I think it's been a very centrist Republican state, meaning that I think we've had party leaders who have been on both sides of the aisle, but who have been willing to work to make progress.
I am Susan Smith. I'm an operations manager for a medical consulting company. I'm 50 years old, white female, and I am Republican.
My name is Bob Shue. I'm a heavy equipment transporter. I'm 55 years old. I'm a white and American Indian, I'm a male, and I'm a Republican.
We're married.
You know, when I grew up in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and I don't remember there being all of this division. You know, people understood and respected that we're all different, and this is the great melting pot, and this is what was kind of beaten into us as we were growing up, is that everyone has something to bring. You know, it's America. That's the whole point of this country, is to immigrate here and bring what you have and embrace other people's cultures. And it wasn't all of this cultural appropriation, and you can't do that because that's a white thing, and you can't do that because it's a black thing, or that's a Latina thing. It was all just, you know, look what I've brought to the table, and look what I've brought, and look what I have. And I know that there were riots and things like that. I remember there being social injustice.
But not like turn now.
Yeah, I think people are just more divided now more than ever, and I just hate all of the hate.
Well, for me, my number one issue for voting is I vote for people that are pro-life, and then I'm also a financial conservative. I believe we should pay our bills, and we shouldn't be $25 trillion in debt.
Yeah, and I would say that both of us, we're not party voters. I mean, we take an active interest.
I know there's a lot of bad stuff in the conservative side and the Republican side, but the majority of it, for me, I agree with, so I vote Republican. There's always some bad with the good, period.
Right. But if you're watching, I mean, you know, you do your research, and you're not going to vote for someone that you don't agree with just because they're Republican. I voted for Obama the first term as a registered Republican. I voted for Obama his first term because I believed in the things that he said. I didn't see him.
Lies.
Yeah, I didn't see that action. So I did not vote for him the second time. I think Trump's doing a great job. He's not my favorite person. I'm not saying that I'd like to hang out with the guy. But
well, we always say he's good on policy and not so good on personality.
Right. He is good on policy, though. And I think, you know, 30 years from now, when all of the dust is settled and the,
history,
you know, all of that,
written,
that when the history books are written and the people look back, they're going to be like, wow, he did a lot more for this country than, you know, certainly that people know about now.
Special thanks to KMUW Stephen Basaha for bringing us a snapshot of Wichita, Kansas, ahead of the presidential election.
The pandemic is aggravating one of the housing market's longest standing issues. That would be lack of supply. At the end of August, there were less than 1.5 million single family existing homes for sale. That's the lowest number in decades. The low inventory is driving up prices as more people rush to buy new homes because of record low mortgage rates. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So pending home sales were up by more than 8% in August, according to the National Association of Realtors. What is driving this huge demand for housing, especially given the economic situation right now?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. That before the pandemic hit, the housing market was experiencing a nice tick up. And that was really around people making more money, feeling more secure. Maybe their credit was getting a little bit better. So that was all happening. Now, add the pandemic on top of that. And clearly, there are a lot of people who are able to work from home. And those people may say, I need more space. I need more of a workspace environment. Or maybe I'm going to be working home for a longer period of time, maybe forever. So put it all together. You've got low mortgage rates. You've got a lot of people who are still employed and making more money. And you have an almost frenzy in the housing market in certain areas of the country.
When it comes to those low mortgage rates, though, a lot of that has to do with what the Federal Reserve has been doing. And they say that they're going to do that for a long time. Shouldn't mortgage rates stay low for some time to come?
Yes, I think they will. They may not stay this low, but remember that mortgage rates act slightly differently than the rates that the Federal Reserve does control. The Fed controls short-term rates. But that said, I mean, you've got 30-year fixed rates below 3%. It's pretty amazing. I think that what's really, really important about the housing market and affordability is you can have a low mortgage rate, but if there are so few homes on the market that prices are rising and you've got to pay more for that, it doesn't allow you to just blow through your whole budget. It allows you to actually say, okay, I can afford a certain amount of house. I better run my numbers no matter what to make sure I can do this.
Well, and lending standards have gotten much stricter since the 2008 financial crisis, right?
Yeah, this may be the lesson learned for the banking industry, because, of course, when we go back into the boom and bust of, you know, let's say the 2000s, the early 2000s, we heard these stories about lenders just extending money to anyone with a heartbeat. Now we find that mortgage credit availability has dropped down to its lowest level since March of 2014. So you really need good credit so you can get those lower rates. You know, it's fascinating. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York found that the median credit score on mortgages originated in the second quarter, it was up at 784. That is a 21-year high. So certainly lenders are being choosier about the money that they are extending to home buyers.
And it's making it more difficult for first-time home buyers to get into the market. What kind of impact could that have?
I don't think it's great news when first-time home buyers are shut out. We were seeing that early on in the recovery from the financial crisis, 2010, 11, 12, 13, that we just didn't see a lot of new buyers out there. I'm hopeful that if some of these people are staying to their game plan, sticking to the numbers that they've run, they'll be able to do it. But you really need a ton of patience in these kinds of markets.
That is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst. Jill, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump's coronavirus diagnosis has upended his reelection campaign with just about 1 month until Election Day. Early voting, of course, is already underway in more than a dozen states, and many more are accepting mail-in ballots. Let's bring in NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid. Hi, Asma.
Hi there.
Well, the president is trying to project strength while he's hospitalized at Walter Reed. His Twitter account has sent at least 19 tweets today. He's been releasing videos periodically, like this one over the weekend.
So it's been a very interesting journey. I learned a lot about COVID. I learned it by really going to school. This is the real school. This isn't the let's read the book school. And I get it and I understand it. And it's a very interesting thing, and I'm going to be letting you know about it. In the meantime, we love the USA, and we love what's happening. Thank you.
So obviously, Asma, he's got his eyes on many different audiences when he does something like this. There are people all over the world who want to make sure that the president of the United States is okay. But with his eye on the coming election, what is he trying to do here with all these tweets and videos?
You know, Jeremy, my sense is that he's trying to project this image of vigor and strength. And that's something that the Trump campaign has been trying to do throughout this pandemic. You know, they had criticized Joe Biden, his opponent, for allegedly hiding out in his basement, not doing as many public campaign events. And that Trump, they said, you know, had been going out in person campaigning. The Trump campaign has been knocking on doors, doing indoor canvassing for a while. And the Biden campaign had been much more conscientious and cautious about all of that behavior. So my sense, you know, both from sort of this public ride around to say hello, but also from the tweets, is just this idea of projecting strength. But one thing, Jeremy, about that message, I don't know, you know, sure, maybe it will galvanize supporters of his, but it also could really turn off voters. This idea that he's now really learned about this pandemic when we're 7 months into this crisis and over 200,000 people in the United States have died from COVID-19.
A lot of people have criticized the president who, before his diagnosis, was out holding these huge rallies, possibly putting thousands of people at risk of contracting COVID-19 because many were not wearing masks and they certainly weren't socially distanced in those rallies. Do you expect the president to hold any more big in-person rallies before Election Day?
Gosh, I mean, Jeremy, I think that's such an interesting question. I mean, he says he has learned a lot from this virus and that we'll learn about what he's learned shortly. You know, look, health experts have said for a while that they do recommend people wear masks and socially distance. And to your point, that none of that behavior was consistently going on at his rallies. That all being said, his campaign really, you know, thrives off of rallies. I think the idea, though, that whether or not it will fundamentally even change the president's in-person campaigning is one question. But will it actually change, like, the polarization of this idea of mask wearing itself is really an interesting question to me, right? Because mask wearing has become this kind of the latest sort of battle in the culture wars of this country. People feel very polarized, and I don't have a clear sense that that's actually changing. You know, I was out there in Michigan doing voters interviews on Friday, and I don't have a clear sense that the president's diagnosis has fundamentally shifted attitudes on that.
Let's talk about Joe Biden and what this means for his campaigning. Here he is speaking in Grand Rapids, Michigan on Friday. He wore a mask for the whole speech.
We can get this pandemic under control so we can get our economy working again for everyone. But this cannot be a partisan moment. It must be an American moment. We have to come together as a nation. I'm running as a Democrat, but I will run and govern as an American president.
Now, Biden is in Miami today ahead of a televised town hall event there tonight. How is his campaign responding to what's happening with President Trump?
Well, you know, he has offered his thoughts, obviously, to the president, to the first family, but they are not pausing their campaign. Joe Biden, to our knowledge, has had three COVID tests since the debate, and all three have been negative. So to your point, you know, he was in Michigan on Friday. He's planning to be in Florida today campaigning. You know, the pushback I hear from Democrats is, why should Joe Biden pause his campaign? Because he had been abiding by many of the health experts' guidance about social distancing and not holding these large events. And even the events that he's been doing are not massive mega rallies. And so as long as he is conscientious and cautious moving forward, should he not, you know, go out there and continue campaigning? A valid question. I think the pushback question that I have heard from some folks is, well, Joe Biden himself was on the debate stage with Donald Trump. And is he totally, clearly out of the woods around COVID? You know, look, I'm not a health expert, but they say that they've taken multiple COVID tests and that he was standing, they feel, at a safe distance away from Donald Trump that night.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is, there's going to be a vice presidential candidate debate on Wednesday this week. What is that going to look like now that we know that, you know, the president may have even been infected when he was on the stage with Joe Biden last week?
So, Jeremy, at this point, we have very little information about what the format, the sort of context of what that VP debate is going to look like. We do have a sense that Mike Pence and Kamala Harris will be standing further apart from one another than was originally conceived of, just given COVID concerns. But beyond that, we don't actually have a lot of information about what the format of this debate is going to look and feel and sound like, given the fact that it's happening, as of now at least, with the president, you know, still diagnosed with COVID.
Does President Trump's diagnosis change the stakes for the VP candidates here? There are just more people thinking, well, maybe one of these people, and Joe Biden himself is going to be 78 years old if he becomes president. More people thinking maybe, you know, Pence or Kamala Harris would have a bigger chance of actually becoming president if either side wins.
Jeremy, I think that's an excellent question. In my view, this VP debate is perhaps one of the most consequential vice presidential debates we have seen in years. Partly because of your point, you know, both of the men at the top of the ticket are of elderly age, but also because at this point, you know, the job of the vice presidential pick is to sort of prosecute the case against the opponent. And so in the case of Kamala Harris, much of her criticism to the Trump administration has been about how the president has handled COVID. So how she's able to navigate that criticism at a moment when the president himself has COVID, I think will be fascinating to watch. And then, you know, to Mike Pence, how does he defend the White House's response to COVID? He was the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Mm-hmm. How does he defend the way that the White House dealt with all of this, given, again, that Donald Trump has COVID? I mean, it just sort of throws this wild card into everything. But what I will say, Jeremy, is that we have seen consistently that the White House does not seem to love conversations about COVID. You know, the president's does not have great favorability ratings. I believe it was below 40% is what I've seen around how he has handled COVID-19. And that number has dipped since the spring, and he's lost support both from Democrats and from independents. This is not an issue that the White House ideally would, you know, like to talk about when we are already at a point where people have begun voting. He much prefers to talk about issues like law and order. This, of course, though, his diagnosis makes COVID the central issue.
Well, what about the polls overall right now? Biden has been consistently leading President Trump in national polls. It's a little closer when it comes to some of the key swing states. But what do the polls tell you about the state of the race right now, especially since we're starting to get polls that came out after the first debate between Trump and Biden?
Yeah, I mean, we did see a bump for Joe Biden after that first debate. But I will say, Jeremy, we haven't really seen, you know, polling that gives us any indication of how the president's diagnosis might affect the race. Mm-hmm. So because those two events happened within such close proximity to one another, I'm still really cautious about overinterpreting the polls from that first debate. I think that the president's diagnosis, in my mind, could go one of two ways. I mean, obviously, he may enjoy some level of empathy from some voters around, obviously, his diagnosis. But then as the weeks go on, will that empathy wear off as people, you know, again, see how he has handled the virus writ large? And the big unknown in all of that, though, in my view, is does he fundamentally change the way that he has handled the pandemic and how he himself is campaigning? And we just don't have a clear sense of that yet.
Do you think that there will be another two presidential debates between Trump and Biden, given everything that's going on?
Well, as of now, they are still on the calendar. Again, I think just the biggest unknown is that we have a president who is supposed to be on that debate stage, who as of now has tested positive for COVID. And whether or not he is actually in the clear by the next debate in Miami, what, that's October 15th? I mean, that is a huge unknown. And even if he is, will Joe Biden, his opponent, want to stand on the same debate stage as him? Again, I just don't have a clear sense of that yet.
That is NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid with just about 4 weeks left until Election Day. Asma, thank you.
You're welcome.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo today ordered new restrictions in parts of Brooklyn and Queens starting tomorrow, including hundreds of school closures. This comes after New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio signaled new changes over the weekend. Some of the areas seeing spikes in coronavirus cases include ultra-Orthodox communities. Eric Adams is in one of those communities most impacted. He's president of the Brooklyn Borough. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes. So, Eric, public health officials are very concerned right now. The positivity rate is now between 3% and 8% in some neighborhoods. What are you telling residents in your borough?
It's very important that we come together as not only one borough, but one city to have a plan that really goes on the ground and understand the diversity of this city, both in language and in cultures. Government has an obligation and communities have a responsibility to coordinate and follow the basic procedures so that we can remain safe.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. Late last month, the mayor said he was doing vigorous outreach in various communities, bringing in a number of Yiddish speakers to help. But you tweeted yesterday that the city has failed to work with communities with language and cultural barriers to stop this virus. Where's the disconnect here?
We have continually communicated with the city as though we have one language, one culture. When you hold daily briefings on a national, state, or city level that are just predominantly English-speaking, there's clearly a disconnect. 47% of Brooklynites speak a language other than English at home. You can't have a one-size-fits-all approach. And many people say, well, this has been going on for 7 months. Everyone should know it by now. That is just not true. Changing human behavior is a constant reinforcement and reminder.
Eric, what do you think the disconnect is then? Because the mayor feels like or has said that the city is doing vigorous outreach to these various communities and actually bringing in folks who can speak the language.
When I spoke with the contact tracers and learned that they were looking to hire people basically only if they had a college degree in certain disciplines, that's just not what's needed on the ground. We don't need a college degree. You need a degree of engagement and you're known in your community. There's a large level of distrust in government right now because of the president we have. And so when you go to immigrant communities, when you go to communities that are afraid that they will be deported because they are not documented, you need credible messengers to have those in conversations. Those are local imams, local rabbis, local pastors, local community groups. That is not what we're seeing, and I have not seen that.
There are reports that people in some communities are hardly wearing masks at all. There are photos that have surfaced of packed religious services with no masks in sight. There are communities that have also seen measles outbreaks in the past because of the lack of vaccinations. What are people telling you about why they're not wearing masks and social distancing? It's very hard for folks to understand what might be happening here.
And what you said is very important, because just as it's difficult for people to understand why we're seeing non-compliance in some areas, we should also understand it's difficult for people to understand when we get mixed messages. We have a president that refuses to wear a mask. We have a large number of people that are stating we should open the city. There's no real problem here. We have never been clear as government on how to properly deal with this. When you add it with some communities that are really reluctant, unfortunately, to understand that this impacts all of us, now you have a recipe for failure and a recipe for disaster.
You say the messages have not been clear. What would you tell people right now about masks and social distancing and what they need to do right now?
Not only the message, but how the message is delivered. I would tell them in a very clear, concise way, wear masks, wash hands, social distance. I will put it in Yiddish. I will put it in Urdu. I will put it in Spanish. I'll put it in English with also visual images, even Chinese. Some people don't listen to radio. They don't watch TV. They don't read American newspapers. If we only deliver our message in the methods that the everyday person does, we're going to miss a large number of people, and that will make this virus spread.
What would you like for the city to do right now as they've laid out this proposed plan that could actually change the way that communities operate starting Wednesday?
Let's inundate these communities with PPEs and information. We have various patrol groups, various groups because of what we've been doing around the census. Let's have those teams also provide the information. Everyone should be given a mask. When I walked through Ballpark, the receptivity to accepting a mask was amazing. That is what we need to do. Let's inundate these areas and then do the surrounding areas so we can stop the spread of the virus from going beyond some of the zip codes that are impacted now.
Eric Adams is Brooklyn Borough President. Eric, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.